with the New Orleans Saints. Had I would have known that, I wouldn't have mentioned that I was a New Orleans Saints fan. So hopefully you won't hold that against me. I am very thankful to be here. Thank you, Dr. May, for the introduction. And thank you to Will also for telling you a little bit about myself. I am very honored and humbled to be here with you. There are several folks here that have had a significant part in the development of my book, which is on the history of the restoration movement in New Orleans. There are a few copies left back here, and I have two here. If any of you, if you need one, just raise your hand, and we'll try to get one to you. The Friends of the Restoration is something that I became involved with in 2008. Tom Childers, Scott Harp, and Ansel Jenkins were ones that organized the trip, and we went through all the main sites in Tennessee and Kentucky, and we went up to Bethany College, and I had the opportunity to visit with them and to learn from them. And I am truly thankful for the efforts of the Friends of the Restoration, because there are a lot of folks in the Brotherhood who are interested in the restoration, but many are interested in rewriting the history. And what this group I appreciate most about is not necessarily an effort to rewrite it, but to preserve it and to retain it and to keep us connected to the idea of restoring the Lord's church in the 21st century. Will Freeman is, as he mentioned, a very good friend as we grew up together at the Hickory Knoll Church of Christ in New Orleans. And there's also some folks here that I'd like to recognize. Brother Wayne Kilpatrick is here. He's mentioned a couple times in the book. He's a faculty member at Heritage Christian University in Florence who published the book. And there's a handful of folks from Ambridge University as well, Dr. Turner, Dr. Patterson, and Raymond Elliott, who serves on the board. And I'm truly thankful for their presence here today. So with all of that said, your handout today is the book. And so if you want to follow along a little bit, I'm not going to read it to you, but I would like to use it as a guide as we talk about some things about the restoration movement in New Orleans. As many of you know, New Orleans is not in the Bible Belt. It never has been, and I don't believe, at least maybe this is a bit doubtful, but I don't know if it ever will be considered a part of the Bible Belt of strong churches facilitating truth in our brotherhood. But there has always been an interest in New Orleans and in Louisiana. In the first chapter of the book, I talk about some early background of New Orleans, including how some of the French settlers, including Robert LaSalle and also Bienville and Iberville, how they found New Orleans. And there was immediately a recognition that New Orleans was very valuable a place in order to conduct business and to make money. And so a lot of folks were able to be interested in moving to New Orleans and to live there, conduct business. However, there was some difficulties as well. As a city wed to river and ocean, it was again valuable, but difficulties persisted. Flooding was a problem a couple of hundred years ago, as it is now, along with sickness and disease. The French were ones that originally had control over New Orleans. You probably have heard of the French Quarter. That goes back to the early days of the settlement of the city. The Spanish came to be in charge for a little while, and then the French again, and also eventually, of course, it became a part of the United States of America. But in those early days, there were some rural Acadians, which later became known as Cajuns, and they were ones that were in South Louisiana. And the Catholic Frenchmen were the settlers of choice. And so if you were an English Protestant, they didn't want you anywhere around the city. There was a lot of bitter animosity between those groups. So from the very, very beginning, New Orleans has been a predominantly Catholic area, and it continues to be that way today. I always enjoy coming to Montgomery and other parts of Alabama, going up to Tennessee and Kentucky, and you can't go 3 or 4 or 5 minutes without passing a Church of Christ somewhere on your journey. But it's simply not that case in New Orleans. Rather, there's Catholic churches on just about every corner that have a very, very strong influence in South Louisiana. And as you can imagine, that's always posed a very difficult task to the people, to the Lord's church, in trying to connect folks to the truth of the gospel. Chapter 2 talks about the restoration movement. I won't tell you much about that as far as some items in a general sense. I trust many of you know about Alexander Campbell and Barton W. Stone, so I won't go at length in introducing those folks. But in some developments early on in Louisiana, by the year 1810, just to give you an idea, New Orleans was the fifth largest city in America. Again, a reflection of the economy and the business that was there. Today, of course, it's nowhere near the top 10, but at one point it was a very vibrant day. And even the Catholic folks had difficulty in keeping their own people there in New Orleans because of the debauchery, because of the sin, and because of the immorality. In fact, some of the Catholic folks themselves refer to these early days as the dark days of Catholicism. So not only has the Lord's church had difficulty, other religious groups have also been challenged in keeping their people. And there's also a distinction between North Louisiana and South Louisiana. As time went by, North Louisiana became known as a sea of Protestantism, but South Louisiana was known as the island of Catholicism. And so as the rest of the United States was basically embracing Protestantism, and then we know eventually many of us going through or going with the Restoration movement, a lot of folks in South Louisiana bypassed that interest in biblical truth and remained stuck on their teaching pertaining to Catholicism. Well, there was a couple of early preachers that may have drawn some interest to you that were interested in preaching the truth in Louisiana. There is a fellow by the name of Jacob Creth Jr., who was known by many as the Iron Duke of the Restoration Movement. Evidently, this guy was pretty thick-skinned, and he was a preacher, but he didn't always say everything exactly the way he was supposed to say it. And in fact, there was one occasion in which there was a death threat given to him if he didn't get out of New Orleans. So I don't know exactly what he preached on that day, but it was something that many people desired for him to get out of there. James Shallon was another fellow who did some preaching in South Louisiana. But the one, I guess, one of the earliest figures that had a lasting impact prior to Alexander Campbell, we'll get to him in just a moment, was a fellow by the name of James Shannon. And James Shannon was one who, there was a fellow by the name of Barry Pointer that later wrote a book about James Shannon entitled Bound to Slavery, James Shannon and the Restoration Movement. But James Shannon began his career in Jackson, Louisiana, which is about 100 miles, give or take, northwest of New Orleans. It's just south of Macomb, Mississippi, coming down I-55 as you get in into Louisiana. Well, what was fascinating about this area of Jackson, Louisiana, was the College of Louisiana. This was before New Orleans had any major universities or colleges, and this College of Louisiana was the hub of academics in Louisiana. Well, James Shannon, a preacher, was also interested in academics, and so he was recruited and became the president of an academic institution, a public institution run by the state, the College of Louisiana. But through his influence, coming in as college president, he was able to convince the board there at the school to allow him to use the chapel to do some preaching. And he was preaching restoration items such as the Bible and the Bible alone. And he was also immersing people and baptizing them for the remission of sins. And by 1836, there was a, quote, Christian church that was meeting there on the campus. James Shannon doing the preaching, and he's also the president of that school. And an interesting tidbit is that in 1837, the College of Louisiana had their first graduation ceremony, and one of the graduates, a fellow by the name of David Lewis Ferris, was the co-valedictorian, but he was also a member of the church where James Shannon preached. And so one of the very first graduates, he was a co-valedictorian, by the way, was a member of the Restoration Movement in Louisiana. Now, unfortunately, we've graduated a lot of other folks not a part of the Restoration Movement since that time, but the very first graduate was a member of the Restoration Movement. By the year 1839, Alexander Campbell comes to New Orleans, and Campbell had a mixed review about his time in New Orleans. And this quote is coming out of the book in the third chapter under the subheading of Alexander Campbell. And this is what Campbell had to say as he is writing this on an item called Incidents on a Tour to the South. This is what he says about New Orleans. This is 1839. "But we have brought a poor article to this market. Few bidders and no buyers inquiring for drafts on the Bank of Heaven. Bonds drawn on the richest bank in the universe and at the cheapest price are unacceptable and uninteresting to this community. But the population is of all castes but the right one, and everything is more in demand than the things of heaven. Still, the Lord's Day is more desecrated in New Orleans than in any other city that I have visited. Many of the sons of the Puritans can do in New Orleans what neither they nor their fathers would or could do at home. The cause of moral and religious improvement cannot greatly advance from its present low and an operative character." It's kind of like Alexander Campbell was fast-forwarding 200 years or so into the present, but he was interested in New Orleans. He was interested in preaching the truth. He's also raising some money for the soon-to-be Bethany College. But he immediately recognized that New Orleans was a place to visit, but not a place to stay. And we have, throughout the history of the Restoration Movement in New Orleans, have had challenge after challenge of keeping preachers in Louisiana because of how difficult it is to live in what many refer to as a mission field here in the United States. And so Campbell was able to get into contact with a lot of folks, including a very famous Protestant preacher by the name of Theodore Clapp. And Campbell also said that he doubted that a large and flourishing congregation of Christians could be soon assembled even in New Orleans. And at Hickory Knoll in New Orleans, on a good day, we'll have 215 people, maybe 220. And that is really, really big for us in attendance. But I know to many of you, 200 people at church would consider to be very, very small. But again, Campbell recognizing in his knowledge of the Brotherhood and seeing the difficulties of Louisiana, he knew there was some value there, but he also knew that there would be enormous difficulties in the Lord's church growing. He also spent some time in Jackson, Louisiana. And so he came to New Orleans. He visited with some wealthy folks trying to raise money for the school. But his main intent, at least I believe this was his main intent, was to come to Jackson, Louisiana, and to influence James Shannon to move from South Louisiana up to Kentucky to become the president of Bacon College. Now, there's some conclusions that have to be based here, but or be made, but one could logically conclude that Alexander Campbell wanted James Shannon to move to Kentucky to become president of Bacon College in order for the rest of the Brotherhood to not think that Campbell was opening his college, Bethany College, in competition with Bacon College. That was what the buzz was about, that Bacon College, it was a Brotherhood school, and it was going to be great. And so Campbell was wanting to open his school, and he thought, and Campbell was brilliant. He was a preacher. He was a college president, but he probably could have been a politician as well. And so his thought was, well, If I help recruit the next president to Bacon College, then maybe that can ease up some of the tension that others are having about Bethany College. So sure enough, Alexander Campbell goes and convinces James Shannon, who's preaching at the institution, academic institution in Louisiana, to pack up, to move out of town, and to be able to go up to Bacon College. And they, I include in there some of the specific reasons why Campbell was able to influence Shannon. Before the war, some other things going on in New Orleans. By the year 1845, the first Christian church of New Orleans was legally chartered. And on their charter, this is what it says. The Christian Church of New Orleans, State of Louisiana, was organized the 21st day of December, 1845, upon the Bible, and the Bible only, as the rule of faith and practice. We pretty much can conclude, doing some further research, that the main foundation, main core of the members there in this church by 1845 were Christians who had come from out of town to New Orleans to work, and they were familiar with the preaching of Alexander Campbell, Barton W. Stone, and they were able to assemble and become chartered there by 1845. By 1850, the congregation, which was meeting on Camp and Melpomene Streets in New Orleans, they had their own building, and so they were excited, and they were bouncing. Well, not bouncing. That's a terrible choice of words there. They were excited with their ability to not only be organized, but to be able to have their own building. And so in 1850, with all of this excitement, they invite a fellow by the name of Jesse B. Ferguson to come. And yeah, that's right, Ansel. Is right. So they invite Jesse B. Ferguson out of Nashville to come and to preach at this dedication service. Those of you familiar with Jesse B. Ferguson, you know that later he was disfellowshipped from the church in Nashville for a number of things, including his belief in spirit spiritualism, that some way, somehow, we would have contact or conversation with spirits of those who had already deceased. And so he was having trouble in Nashville, and so he lands in New Orleans, and I guess they didn't get the email that Jesse had been disfellowshipped, and so he was there, and they were excited, but problems eventually started for the church in New Orleans. A fellow by the name of E.C. Payne, a very wealthy elder in the church, was disfellowshipped, and a lot of that had to do with the influence of Jesse B. Ferguson. But by 1857, Alexander Campbell returns to New Orleans for a second time, and the church had been established for 10 or 12 years or so, and he's there again raising money for his university. And by coincidence, and this was kind of funny, I thought, that he shows up in 1857 at the very same time that James Shannon was also in New Orleans raising money. And so this fella, E.C. Payne, who had been disfellowshipped, he was hosting James Shannon in his home. And so E.C. Payne finds out that Alexander Campbell is coming into town. And so E.C. Payne says, "You know, James, it's been great hosting you. It's been very good having you, but it's time for you to go. I have another guest that is coming in to town." And Alexander Campbell was hosted by E.C. Payne. But they did decide to put their academic interests on side, at least temporarily. And James Shannon and Alexander Campbell reunited in New Orleans for a brief time to help establish the church and to reorganize it after all of the problems with Jesse B. Ferguson. And just as a side note, that I found this of interest when I was in Bethany, that there is one tombstone in the family cemetery plot there that mentions Louisiana, and it is of Alexander Campbell Jr.'s wife, Marianna Purvis, who was from Louisiana. And Alexander Campbell Jr. married this lady who lived some of the time with her husband in Bethany, but also a lot of the time during the year they were in Louisiana as well. We don't know much about what happened to the Lord's Church or the Restoration Movement during the Civil War years. We do know that Tolbert Fanning made a visit to Louisiana sometime at the end of 1860, beginning of 1861, and he writes that he was only able to find two or three Christians in New Orleans worshiping according to the New Testament. I don't know if he was able to find the main group, or by this time the group may have been so disorganized that they were not able to meet with any type of consistency. Well, as the entire Brotherhood is facing challenges after the Civil War, so did the church in New Orleans. And as many of the congregations in New Orleans or in the Brotherhood were facing issues such as instrumental music and the Missionary Society, those issues were a part of the New Orleans struggle as well. William Edwin Hall, those of you that like periodicals, he was a preacher that was in New Orleans in the mid-1870s, and he started a publication called The Iron Preacher that was eventually became relocated to Jackson, Tennessee. There was a preacher by the name of Knowles Shaw, who was known as the singing evangelist. He wrote such songs that we sing, "Tarry With Me," and "We Saw Thee Not," and some of the songs like that. He came to New Orleans as a singing evangelist, and what he brought with him was a desire to preach, but he also brought an organ with him, one of these little organs that he could use. And so as he came to New Orleans, he was wanting to use that organ. But the brethren, some thought it was okay, others thought it wasn't okay. I don't believe he ended up using it, but it was the preview for more and more disagreement and contention pertaining to instrumental music in worship. There was also some converts from the African American community as early as the 1870s, which does show some interest in reaching out to various people in South Louisiana. Well, there are some more things that were happening. I have a chapter in the book called The 25-Year Struggle. And it seemed for 25 years the church in New Orleans could not figure out who they were, or what they were doing, or why they existed. Again, some problems with all kinds of things, instrumental music, American Christian Missionary Society, and also the idea that they were broke. They had no money whatsoever. In fact, one of the fellows, they had a visitor by the name of Zenas, who visited New Orleans, and he wrote a letter to the Gospel Advocate in 1883, and he was talking about his recent visit to New Orleans. And he mentioned the poor foundation of the church in New Orleans. And he mentioned four specific problems. Worldly conformity, which that's no surprise. That's been a problem since the very beginning. The word alone theory, which we're not going to go into much detail about that. The Dr. John Thomas's Elpis Israel doctrine pertaining to some things about prophecy. And also what he called Jesse B. Ferguson's post-mortem gospel. So still, Jesse B. Ferguson has had a negative influence, and the church is still was still trying to deal with that. Our brother Ansel Jenkins characterizes Jesse B. Ferguson as one of the heretics of the Restoration movement. And so there are some problems, more problems, and there was on record in the documents of the American Christian Missionary Society that says, in describing the church in New Orleans, it said the church at New Orleans has had a checkered career. They say a bunch of things about some of the efforts that were going on, and they conclude the statement by saying, we ought to have several churches in New Orleans. That should have been the case, but it simply was not a reality. In fact, the resources were actually there. New Orleans was a very financially stable city, but with all of the other things going on, it seemed like the church in New Orleans had difficulty taking off. Well, division becomes reality. After 25 years of struggling, the church decided to officially split ways. And a lot of the negative influence, or the person who basically was the icing on the cake, was an Alabama preacher. Nothing against Alabama, of course, but then there was a... we're still upset about you guys beating LSU, but anyway, that's a side story. There's a fellow by the name of Oscar Pendleton Spiegel, O.P. Spiegel, who Brother Kilpatrick says that O.P. Spiegel may have been one of only two people that did not continue in the sound teachings pertaining to graduates of the Mars Hill Bible College. Well, in the same way Jesse B. Ferguson came to New Orleans to cause some problems, O.B. Spiegel comes to New Orleans as well, and they decide to form what is known as the Uptown Church. And so for the first time, we're in the early part of the 1900s, we have two distinct groups. We have the A Cappella Non-Missionary Society group, and also this new church who embraced instrumental music and who embraced the idea of the Missionary Society. Now, this new group became known as the Soniat Avenue Christian Church, and then eventually became known as a group that continues today as the St. Charles Avenue Christian Church. Now, the A Cappella Non-Missionary Society Church is still today legally chartered as the First Christian Church of New Orleans, but in their present location of where they're at now, they've never had instrumental music, and they've never been in favor of the Missionary Society. And so after this split occurs, the church is trying to figure out who they are and what they're wanting to do. And a good guy from Alabama shows up, and his name is T.B. Larimore. And he preaches 8 times or so in New Orleans. And this is in early 1905. And he's renewing the zeal and the optimism of the brethren there, and probably smoothing over some of the difficulties that were occurring with the things going on with O.P. Spiegel. And at this time, as the instrumental music folks and missionary society folks are finally doing their own thing, the church, the a cappella church, they decide that they want to, as an outreach effort, begin a Christian high school in New Orleans. A fellow by the name of David Lipscomb Watson, his name will come up again in a few minutes. David Lipscomb Watson was one who was very wealthy. He was a doctor, a pediatrician, and he was a deacon in the church and later an elder. And so he had some money. All the problems were gone. And so he had the idea that the church could start an academic outreach effort, and it was known as the Christian High School. Well, they recruited a guy by the name of Amos C. Harris, from Montgomery, Alabama, of all places. And he became the minister of the congregation, and he also became the principal of the school. And A.C. Harris was a very big encouragement to the church, because unlike these other folks that would just visit for a little while and then leave, A.C. Harris decided that, hey, I want to come to New Orleans, and I want to stay, and I want to work with the brethren there. And so they made some things. They made a couple of payments. They got a building program going, and the church seemed like they were in really good shape. Well, by the year 1907, there are some things going on. The year 1907 is a integral year in the history of the Churches of Christ in New Orleans. Three things happened in that year. Number one, the congregation decided to never use instrumental music or the missionary societies. They had a clause that was inserted into their charter that reflected that none of those two items would be allowed in the church. Secondly, in 1907, the building that the congregation still uses today on the corner of 7th and Camp Streets in New Orleans, that building was finished. And then third, and most importantly, a fellow by the name of Stanford Chambers moves to New Orleans to become the assistant minister and also the assistant principal for the school. And so the brotherhood was really, really excited. In fact, the fellas, A.C. Harris, were writing the items to the Gospel Advocate in Nashville. The Gospel Advocate was posting these items and asking the brotherhood for support of these efforts. And it seemed like all of the good items were going on. The Gospel Advocate helped recruit Stanford Chambers to New Orleans. And it seemed like everything was going well. But what no one realized is that, yes, Stanford Chambers brought a desire and a zeal with him to be in New Orleans, but no one realized that he was bringing a premillennial background with him. And so within a very, very short period of time, Stanford Chambers, he decides to help David Watson with this journal that they decided to build or decided to begin, and it was known as the Christian Word and Work. David Watson as the financial backing, as the editor, and Stanford Chambers, who is the preacher, who is the academic person, the writer. And so this Christian Word and Work was a periodical that was printed and was distributed all over South Louisiana. And so at this time, nobody really knew about Stanford Chambers and his premillennialism. And so Chambers is writing some things, and David Watson was in full support, and everything was going real well. In fact, I have a graphic of the Volume 1, Number 1 of the Christian Word and Work, which we're going to get to in a minute. It later became known as the Work and Word and Work, the premillennial premier journal for that group of the Brotherhood. Well, A.C. Harris decides that he's finished. For whatever reason, he decided that he needed to pursue other items. I believe he even ended up in the Christian church. Well, so Chambers becomes not assistant principal, but principal, and not assistant minister, but minister. And so he's got some more power, he's got some more influence. And so he recruits some people to move to New Orleans and to help the church and also write in the Christian Word and Work. And these fellas, one from Indiana by the name of E.E. Beck, another a guy named D.L. Cooper from Nashville, Tennessee, and a third fellow by the name of Claude Neal from Indiana, they each accepted an invitation to teach at the school, to write in the journal, and all three of these men had premillennial beliefs. And so Dr. David Watson, he was the editor with the money. He was not premillennial. But now you have Stanford Chambers, who is preaching and is the editor and has just brought in three more guys that have similar beliefs. I think you can see the tension that is about to uncover. Well, this Christian Word and Work has done a lot of had done a lot of good things, had spread all throughout South Louisiana. And in fact, there was a point in which all of the mortgage and all the bills had been paid by the church and by the school, so things were going real well. But by the year 1913, David Watson, for one reason or another, he sells the journal to Stanford Chambers. And instead of being called the Christian Word and Work, it's shortened to the Word and Work. And as Chambers is taking over, he established some new departments for the journal, including the Department of Prophecy, which he was in charge of that section of the journal. And I have for you a graphic of that September 1913 issue that you can see includes that Department of Prophecy. Well, as you know, the hub of premillennial thought in the Brotherhood was with Robert Henry Bull, or R.H. Bull, and he was in Kentucky. And so as the direct result of Stanford Chambers and the Word and Work, the 7th and Camp Streets Church of Christ became heavily involved with premillennialism. And Stanford Chambers, even though he was a part of a very, very small group of Christians in New Orleans, became a part of, and the church in New Orleans became in a negative spotlight to the rest of the Brotherhood. As the Brotherhood is dealing with this issue of premillennialism, in the past they had full support from the Brotherhood to pay off their debt and to help with the school, but now with premillennialism, the Brotherhood had blockaded their support of the 7th and Camp Streets Church. And so, and this was largely the result of Stanford Chambers. David Watson, who is the former editor and the guy with all the money, he was disfellowshipped by the church. Stanford Chambers decides to sell the Word and Work to R.H. Bull, and so that's how it was moved up to Kentucky. And I have a map in the book. It's around page 62. And just to give you an idea of how fast this spread, in the directory known as the Churches of Christ in the United States, in the 2006 edition, there were approximately 81 premillennial congregations in the United States. Most of these were in the Kentucky, Indiana area, but about 20 congregations, or about 25% of the premillennial Churches of Christ in the entire Brotherhood, were located in South Louisiana. And to this day, many of the congregations, albeit very small, continue to have that premillennial influence. Well, Stanford Chambers, after doing all of that, they decide to close the Christian High School, and he sells out as well, and well, probably a good thing, and moves to Kentucky to work with R.H. Bull. And by that time, the church, although they were in a very difficult situation, they didn't realize it, but one of the biggest blessings that they experienced in 1929 was the arrival of Clifton L. Gaines, Sr. And in my mind, that's a significant stopping point. As you think about the early restoration movement in New Orleans, I think you can trace it through the impact of Stanford Chambers. But the story does not end there with premillennialism. So don't feel like it. In fact, that was actually marked a significant ending point to the growth of that when Stanford Chambers moved out. But Clifton L. Gaines, Sr. moves to New Orleans and brings with him energy, he brings with him sound doctrine, and he brings with him, he's able to make some money very, very quickly and helps the rest of the churches of Christ in New Orleans. So I'll leave it at that point and let you finish the story. Again, don't finish with Stanford Chambers, but definitely finish. As you know, Clifton L. Gaines he was very prominent in New Orleans, and his son, Clifton L. Gaines Jr., is about to be 90 years old and is chancellor at Harding University. So with that said, we may have a minute or two if you have any questions or comments. Well, that's good. Those of you that are, I know a lot of you do some research. If I have missed anything or if something has piqued your interest, I definitely would enjoy dialoguing with you pertaining to New Orleans. Yes, sir.
What connection did this Gaines to the General Gaines, doctor that fought against, his army fought against that of President Garfield?
I'm not aware of a connection. To my knowledge, I don't think it's the same same group, same family.
Was that Gaines or Gaino that was the general?
It may be Gaino. Yeah, that's right. There you go. Okay. Yes, sir. Bill Wayne.
Harry, can all of your research about the church in New Orleans, and of course I know you know more about the church outside of New Orleans too through all the research, have you ever encountered a man by the name of Benoit Johnson? B-E-N-O-I-T?
Yes, I have. He's, if I'm remembering correctly, he was a part of some churches in the Amy area. Does that sound familiar?
One of his granddaughters lives in Athens.
Okay.
And she's been, you know, sort of, as she finds it, sort of feeding to me some material on him. And I'm wanting to learn a lot more about it.
Okay. I've got some stuff on him that I can send your way.
He wasn't given that name at birth. He decided, working amongst the French people, that he needed a French-sounding name.
So Benoit was a pretty good choice, yeah.
Johnson doesn't sound very, very French.
Yeah, but yeah. Okay. I think I have some information on him.
I'd like to get anything on him that I could, because especially these ladies have some pictures of him, and we can hopefully build a pretty good little account of him. But he was so valuable in the work in Louisiana.
Yeah, he was. All right. Anybody else?
Now, did the premillennial college in Louisiana or the Bible share?
Yes, they did in Hammond, Louisiana, at Southeastern University in Hammond. They had a Bible chair, and the fellow that was in charge of that originally was a guy named Ambrose Knox Ramsey, and I talk a little bit about that, but that has faded out, but that was a very significant movement at that time.
It died out then.
Yes, yeah. In fact, the preacher, the current preacher, and I am I'm friends with the guy at the 7th and Camp Streets Church, which still retains a premillennial focus. His name is Richard David Ramsey, and it was his grandfather who was originally the chair there. And in the house where that little program was, that the house is still there, and there are hundreds of books that are from his grandfather's collection. And so there's some a lot of, I'm sure, valuable information there. Thank you very much. Oh, yes, sir. Go ahead.
I just wanted to mention Dr. David Ramsey.